Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 23rd of November. Monday at 9 is always all things political. Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School, one of our favorite all things political guests. If you've never heard him before, you'll soon find out why. His new book is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, just being released. Also, Rightward Bound, Making America Conservative in the 1970s, Taxing America, Wilbur D. Mills, Congress and the State, 1945 to 1975. He is a news commentator for CNN.com, and he writes frequently and is heard frequently on radio and television all over the country. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Zelizer, and we invite you to join us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use an email, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our number two of our program today, a conservative take on health care reform. As you know, the Senate did pass the vote to open debate on health care reform on Saturday night, completely partisan vote. And we'll be talking with a senior research fellow in health policy from the Heritage Foundation, hour number two, who has very deep concerns about health care reform. So that's what's coming up these 2 hours. A reminder, David Plouffe is joining us tomorrow during our 10 o'clock hour. He was the mastermind of the Obama campaign, and he's written about that campaign in his brand new book, The Audacity of Hope: The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. So that's coming up tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Professor Julian Zelizer is joining us now. Hello, Professor Zelizer. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We may as well start with health care reform because it happened on Saturday night. But wow, what a partisan vote, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, any continued desire for bipartisanship in Washington became even more fleeting after Saturday night. Once again, Republicans are lined up against this bill, and Democrats generally are in favor of it, with a few exceptions. But it was a party line vote, and that's what we've seen continually almost throughout Obama's presidency.
Mm-hmm. So, what does this bode for passage of health care reform? They're going to have a hard time getting this bill through the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Democrats were pretty excited, actually, that they got all 60 to vote in favor of this procedural decision. All it was basically a vote to allow this to continue, meaning now they can debate, amend, and even filibuster. If they didn't vote in favor of that, they wouldn't have been able to move that far. But there were a lot of warning signs. So all the moderates or centrists who lined up in favor of the 60 vote on Saturday issued some pretty strong warnings. Senator Lieberman saying he won't vote for the public option. Senator Nelson saying he won't vote for the existing bill. And a lot of won'ts and ifs. So I think Democrats still have a lot to resolve in the final stage of this if they're going to get it to pass. Some liberals are also warning not to go too far, and that they're going to kind of demand certain provisions in this bill or they won't support it.
It's a toughie, isn't it? This is just tough to pass anything.
Absolutely. I mean, there's two parts of it. One is health care is always a tough issue, and traditionally health care fails. So the bet is that we'll have inaction rather than action. Historically, Medicare and Medicaid are the exceptions to the rule, and this is an issue that always tends to go down in defeat. But second are the difficulties of governing in this day and age, particularly in the Senate, where kind of the common frequent use of the filibuster combined with intense party polarization means that you have to have everyone in your party lined up and ready to vote yes. And that's a very difficult task. We're talking 60 Democrats. And Democrats have done a great job bringing in a bigger mix of Democrats in the last few years, but now they face the cost of that. The more moderates you bring in, the more divisions there are when you're trying to round up 60 votes.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, where is the public in all of this? Do the polls still show that the public favors a public option? And if so, doesn't that place moderate and conservative Democrats, and Republicans for that matter, in a bit of a pickle?
Well, they do. I mean, the thing is, you know, the wording of polls is always difficult, and clearly the public does favor a public option, and Democratic leaders are trying to use this to push the moderates into their camp. But I think most politicians always suspect that if you word something a little bit differently, you might get very different results, especially if you're talking about something that doesn't exist. So, you know, the public might want a public option, but then they might not want the government to have a stronger role in providing insurance. And that's one of the fears, I think, that some of the moderates have. In conservative states, support for a public option is less than it is in the rest of the country. So, you know, someone from one of these kind of red-blue states, a Democrat who is trying to survive in a Republican state, is going to think about that a lot more than national polls in favor of the public option. But clearly there still is some attachment to that public option. It seems symbolically very important for some people. Even if it might not be the key to the bill, there are a lot of Americans who ultimately kind of can make sense of that part of the legislation, and it's a very complicated bill. So I think symbolically it's become important to some Americans.
Not that he's going to do this, but if the president said, don't send me a bill that doesn't have a public option, it's the biggest part of health care reform. This is also a test, I guess, of how much sway he has. What would the Senate do?
I think the Senate might kill the bill. I mean, I think the moderates, again, made it very clear that several of them won't support the public option. At least in its current form, some won't support it at all. But I think if the president kind of drew a line in the sand and said this must be in the bill, he would only antagonize that group that right now is trying to figure out where they're going to vote. So I think he's aware of this. It hasn't actually been central to the administration. This was not the key to the bill in their minds. More were these health care exchanges they want to set up and the individual mandate, meaning everyone will have to buy health insurance. The idea that will drive down costs. That's really what was important to them from the start. So the public option kind of took on a life of its own, I think, as this debate unfolded. And now they are trapped with it in some ways, and they are dealing with a delicate political situation. But when you have a filibuster 60 supermajority Senate, you can't insist that those moderates do whatever you want them to do.
What do you think of the health care bill?
I'm actually, look, it's a step forward. Millions of people will receive health care as a result of the bill. You know, most of the studies of it have shown that over 20 million Americans might end up with health care who don't have it at this point. That's a good thing. And I think that would be a step forward, providing more competition that would benefit consumers. That's a good thing. There are kind of questions about this bill, though, that I think are impossible to ignore. Most of the cost control mechanisms have been gutted during this process, so it's hard to be confident that this will really diminish the costs of the healthcare system. And it's not clear that the bill is going to provide enough of a subsidy to middle-class Americans to afford the new mandate that they are now required to purchase healthcare. And that could be a very dangerous situation for Democrats, certainly. If they pass this, and a year from now, many Americans are paying more for health care and feeling that it's the fault of the Democrats and the prices aren't going down. So I think those are two kind of red flags in a bill that does have some positive aspects.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to jobs. You wrote a recent column for CNN.com on jobs, comparing Obama's situation to FDR after the Democratic landslide in 1936, and urging him to focus on jobs. And the unemployment situation is terrible in this country right now. He should focus on that, not on the deficit. What can he do about jobs, and do you see him focusing more on the deficit?
Well, there's been stories in the last 2 weeks that deficit reduction is going to be the number one issue come January, that in the State of the Union address, Rahm Emanuel has almost convinced the president that deficit reduction should be issue number one, which will include spending cuts, and that there won't be any major initiatives. And the idea is that unless Democrats do that, they are going to lose a lot of independents in the midterm elections and have their majorities vastly diminished, because independents are showing in polls they're nervous about the size of the deficit. The problem is that this jobless recovery, which you might ask if it's really a recovery at all, is a huge political challenge for the administration. We have over 10% unemployment. Some figures kind of ratchet that up to 19% nationally, and some states like Michigan are over 15%. That's not a happy populace, and the administration, even though it was a campaign Barack Obama that started about Iraq, ended up being about the economy and the promise to do something about economic recovery. So the danger is, if he starts focusing too much on deficit reduction and this jobless recovery, these unemployment rates don't diminish, you don't want to go into the midterm elections with 10% of the population minimum unemployed. That's going to be a very unhappy situation for the party. And many are asking, why did they do health care first rather than the economy first? Some are calling for a second stimulus. That's one proposal. Others are calling to accelerate the existing stimulus. But many are saying that this is not yet the time to focus on deficit reduction.
What happened to that initial stimulus money? Do we see people in jobs now doing whatever, helping with roads or whatever? Is it at work?
It is at work. It's not all been spent. I mean, it was a very kind of gradual, incremental schedule for spending the money. It trickled out. Some of it in some communities is being spent. You might drive down a road and see one of those signs that says this is essentially brought to you by the stimulus plan with the name of the legislation. And so you can see this in communities, especially on public works projects. There's some science projects that are getting funding. But overall, I mean, I don't think it's not a New Deal kind of program where it literally dominates communities, the public works projects. So I think many economists say it's done something. It's clearly helped to stabilize the situation and give some people jobs. But in many ways, it was much smaller than many of Barack Obama's supporters expected. And that might undermine some of its effect, ironically enough.
It's not a New Deal program. It should be a New Deal program.
Well, that's up for debate, but you can say that this is a pretty severe economic recession we're in right now. And it's not just that the recession is severe. We're in an era where it takes longer for recessions to end, or especially unemployment rates to drop. Because of the erosion of our manufacturing sector and the exodus of jobs abroad, many jobs that are gone will never return. So we don't have a depression the way we did in the early 30s with 25% of the workforce unemployed. But clearly we have high enough numbers that you can argue it warrants more aggressive public works programs until we can get out of this jam.
Can we compare, and if so, how, the situation to FDR, Democratic landslide 1936, economy suffers a devastating recession 1937?
Yeah, that's the recession that I wrote about, and what happened is in 1937 the economy was doing better. It seemed to have stabilized, at least. Unemployment had dropped, and after the 36 election, FDR decides to focus on deficit reduction. Sounds a little like today. Secretary of Treasury under FDR, Henry Morgenthau, said that it's time to basically, you know, throw away the bandages and let the patient stand on his own two feet. And that the time had come to show America that the New Deal had worked and all this public spending wasn't needed. So they cut public spending in the summer of 1937, a lot of it public jobs programs, and then the economy in the late summer, early fall, slips into a huge recession. Roosevelt's critics call it the Roosevelt Recession. And many say it was part of why in the 1938 midterm elections, liberal Democrats really suffered, and conservative Southerners and Republicans increased their numbers in both chambers, which caused problems for the rest of FDR's administration. There are many economists who still say that cutting spending so early in 1937 was a bad move. And again, it was on the basis of refocusing on deficit reduction.
So when does the president know the time is right to focus on deficit reduction?
He doesn't know when the time is right. Economics is really, some say it's not a total science. So there is guessing work. And so he has to listen to the best advice he has, but there are many. It's not as if everyone in the administration or surrounding him is saying to cut spending yet. This is coming from a certain segment of the administration worried primarily about the politics of deficits, not the economics of deficits. There are many, many economists who are saying the time has not come yet to do this, even those who are fiscally conservative. So how does he know? It's a guess. But the question is kind of, do you guess about doing it right now or do you wait a little longer? The unemployment rate gives some evidence you might want to wait a little longer.
We're going to take phone calls. Our lines are all filled. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More on healthcare reform, the second hour of our program today, with a guest who has severe concerns, deep concerns about the bill that's before the Senate and the House bill, for that matter. Our guest, senior research fellow in health policy at the Heritage Foundation. Back to phone calls. Let's start phone calls now for Professor Zelizer. Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to quickly list four hypocrisies and let the listeners or perhaps the guests choose which is the worst. Two relate to the health care crisis, the hypocrisy of men who think that health care might cost too much, but they want to keep their prescriptions for Cialis or Viagra intact. Second one in that area is that the Chamber of Commerce is saying we can't afford health care because unemployment is at a 25-year high, without citing their role in creating this unemployment along with the actions of the Bush administration. And the final two relate to moral issues. The Catholic Church for inviting Anglicans who want to discriminate against gays and women to come into the church. And finally, Glenn Beck and a number of conservative pundits have been calling Barack Obama, saying that he's raping the Constitution, raping the people with his policies, which, of course, takes us back to the process of stinking cheating called Willie Hortonizing the president.
Professor Zelizer.
Those are arguments you hear. I think there are others that you could add to the list for supporters of the healthcare. The other kind of hypocrisy is conservatives using Medicare, defending Medicare to oppose government intervention in healthcare. But one of the things I think it points to, especially the reference to Glenn Beck, is the tone of the debate is often so far removed from the substance of the bill. It's rather striking that there isn't a lot of space in American politics for serious discussion about what to do with health care. The incentives for both parties are to really play to extreme elements in the party, to play to the 24-hour media, which thrives on very polemical kind of arguments that are often far removed from reality. And there's little area to talk about, is a health care exchange the best opportunity to expand coverage and to reduce costs. And so part of what you get is kind of very stark hypocrisies and also very hysterical rhetoric rather than decent, sound discussion from both parties.
Let's talk about health care as a moral issue, though. We've done so many programs. We did a whole series on health care reform in the past 3 months, focusing on a lot of other countries in the world. All industrialized countries cover many more citizens than the United States does. It's close to having everybody covered. Is it a moral issue problem in this country that we make it, well, it's the money, well, it's, we don't want government control, we don't want to move towards socialism. But there are a lot of countries that are capitalist countries that do a different thing with their health care reform, and they find a way to pay for all of that. Is there something peculiar about America?
Well, I mean, the moral part of this is very interesting. I think the moral rhetoric about health care reform has really been absent from this debate. And the president, I think, has consciously decided not to use that kind of language. The idea that there's a moral right to health care, and one way or another, we have to find a way to achieve that. That was an argument that was pretty familiar in the 60s through the 1970s when Ted Kennedy was the key Democratic champion calling for a national single-payer health system. And the claim was it wasn't technical, it wasn't about deficit reduction and cost control, it was about giving everyone that fundamental right. It was a civil right. And that language faded away. Bill Clinton was, I think, the first to really abandon it, because the idea was, in a conservative age, that argument wouldn't work. It would kind of open you up to arguments about being a socialist, and it would get you involved in all that older kind of rhetoric that was always so damaging to health care. And I think Barack Obama's followed Clinton's model, and he shied away from making that claim. So I think it's been absent from the debate, but it's true that most countries have some kind of system that moves very close to that goal, and that the United States, for many reasons, in part because we developed a private healthcare system here before we had almost any government intervention in healthcare markets, and in part because of kind of an anti-government ideology which has been around since the founding, various factors have led us to have a rather meek kind of government role for healthcare other than Medicare and Medicaid, where, again, we've seen an exception.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim, for your call. Anne from Madison is next. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Well, people haven't been, you know, people who don't have private health insurance don't have it because they can't afford it. And the companies, mostly small companies, but a lot of greedy, very big companies don't have it because they can't afford it, because it's so expensive and it's, you know, it's so gouging. And on Jesse Jackson's Sunday program, he has a guest from time to time named, I think, David Shiner, who was President Obama's longtime physician. He isn't anymore. Who believes that all of these so-called health care reform bills are absolutely outrageous, and that what people need is what people in all sensible countries have, which is a single-payer system that's cheapest, most efficient, has a huge base, and will cover everybody. And Americans really need to educate themselves. They need to think for themselves, and they need to fight this system of bribery that means we're getting these bills that discriminate, that force people to buy overpriced insurance from companies that have gouged them and defrauded them and denied them payment for their medical treatment. How is this reform in any way, and how is it constitutional to force people essentially to use their tax money, that's what it amounts to provide to buy insurance from companies that are determined to use their money to enrich their stockholders? It's an absolutely insane system, and I think we'd be much better off with nothing and revise our system of legalized bribery before we start working on a system that's going to make it impossible to get the private insurance companies out of our so-called healthcare system.
Professor?
I actually think that call has some arguments the Democrats are going to have to contend with in the next few years, even if this bill passes. Democrats made a choice. The White House made a choice, as Clinton did, not to go for a single-payer system, not to go for a total overhaul of the program. Bill Clinton, in fact, had a much bolder idea about reforming health care. He wanted to gut the employer-based health care system that we have. And Obama, for political reasons, I think, the idea that was just not feasible, has gone for a very middle-of-the-road approach, a very Clintonian approach, which will keep much of the private health care infrastructure in place and, A, require Americans to buy that health care, and, B, then impose a regulatory system that tries to mitigate some of the worst abuses of the system. So, you know, dealing with pre-existing conditions as one example, and, you know, requiring companies to do certain things to get into these health care exchanges that Americans are going to be looking for when they go shopping for their health care coverage. That said, it leaves the private health care delivery system pretty intact. I don't think it's going to fundamentally reform who we're buying from, and it's going to depend on this regulatory structure working. And I think there are many Democrats, not moderates, liberals, who are nervous about what this call just said, that you're going to require everyone to buy it, but you're going to require them to buy it from the same broken system, and that maybe the first year it will work okay, but by year two, costs will still be pretty high, and some of these problems, the pathologies of the system, will still very much be in place, and you'll have some very angry voters, angry not at the health care system, but about Democrats forcing them to buy into it. And so I think that's, right now, now in designing this program in the Senate and then in conference committee, they really need to think some of this through because that could be a huge political liability. This bill could turn into a liability for the Democratic Party. It's also worth noting no one's going to get a benefit at minimum till 2013, which many people don't realize. The House bill, this doesn't start till 2013, the benefits, and 2014 in the Senate bill. That's a long time to wait, especially as people are starting to buy into the system.
So that scenario you just described, then perhaps a public option would trigger in?
That's the idea of the public option. Yes, the public option can be controlled by the government. So, meaning, you know, they could control the terms of the insurance. They will provide the insurance. And so one way to do it is right up front. So you'll have all the private insurance options on this healthcare network. Imagine an Expedia where you're shopping for this. But then you'll have this public option by the government where they could kind of keep the cost at a certain level and keep the rules and regulations in favorable terms for consumers. Another would be that it would kick in, you know, after so many years if the healthcare exchanges are not working as hoped for. The other, which is this opt-out provision, meaning the government would provide public option, but that states could opt out of that system. And some say most states would never opt out once a benefit is offered. But that is why the public option for some liberals is seen as essential. Again, getting to this call, that's the insurance that the Democrats and the government can have that this thing doesn't go awry.
Mm-hmm. Well, why wouldn't they opt out?
Well, the thought is if you know, 30 states have this in place or 40 states have this in place, and it takes a proactive decision by a governor or state legislature to say, we don't want to give you this benefit, that most government officials won't do that. It's like stimulus money. When the stimulus money was provided, some Republicans said that they wouldn't take it. In the end, most took it, because once that money is there, constituents want it. So the incentives would work for keeping it.
Yeah. Mike from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. So 90% of the people are working, and they have savings accounts. A lot of us do anyway. And if we inflate the system with cheap money that we've just print up in order to save people's jobs and things, then are we going to cut into other people's savings accounts, the 90% that you're not talking about? And also, you know, in China, they got like $1 trillion plus invested in our treasury system. They paid with good money to buy those bills and whatnot. And now, if we cheapen the money, aren't they going to lose faith in our system? Why would they want to lose money by investing in us and propping us up, because that's what they're doing? All because we feel so warm-hearted, fuzzy about helping everybody.
That's a conservative argument that is gaining currency. The Saturday Night Live had a skit already capturing just that on Saturday night, a press conference between the Chinese leadership and the U.S., where that argument was made. Fears of inflation, fears of diminishing savings are the argument that some independents are nervous about. I think with China, I don't think that's at the top of many people's minds, and there's a lot of sense China is not about to pull out its investment at this point. We're not even close to that. But obviously the fears of inflation, fears of diminishing savings are there. But I don't think anyone is arguing we should have these levels of deficits forever. That's not the question. The question is, you know, when do you start moving into cutting mode? We've had high deficits before. During the 30s through World War II, we had very large deficits, and that was followed by the American century, our greatest period of economic growth. So kind of the idea that the deficits automatically are going to lead to these devastating consequences, I think, should be looked at skeptically. And again, that there is room to continue spending, particularly on jobs programs, when, you know, if 90% of the country is doing okay, but that number is even high. I mean, if you really want to totally calculate unemployment, underemployment, you get much closer to 20%. That These are high numbers we're talking about. And you can't, it's not good for the economy. Many of these people are the ones who spend the most if they have the money. So there's all kinds of arguments, economic arguments, to deal with this problem.
Thanks very much for your call. We go next to Ben from Green Bay. Hi, Ben.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Oh, we can hear you.
Okay. Hello to your guest, Harvard graduate here. So we're at odds already. I would like to address the fact that the new health bill will be $1 trillion. How are we going to pay for this?
That's what the Senate is working on right now. So how is this paid for? Part of it will be through Medicare reductions. Many people are nervous about. Will the government go through with cutting Medicare payments? That's one source. There will be some kind of tax mechanism, either on these Cadillac premiums, which are very high-level premiums that some in the Senate want, or in the House they're proposing some kind of progressive tax mechanism to pay for it. Senator Reid is also looking at increasing the payroll tax on high-income workers, Medicare taxes, to pay for part of this. So those are the funding mechanisms that are being proposed. We do have programs we pay for that cost these levels of money. So it's about kind of where do you want to invest. Many people who are critical of investing in health care are more than happy to invest in the military and national security. This is the debate. It's a moral debate. It's about choices. It's about where our government money can go. The other part of this is people have to pay for this anyway. I mean, that's the kind of illusion, is that if you don't pay for some kind of government system, that the 90% or everyone else will get off scot-free. But the fact is, premiums are not only rising, but they can rise very significantly in the next few decades. And people have to consider that a form of tax they're going to pay. So it's about, what do we pay for that will give us the best return? That's the question, not about paying more or not paying more, because I think that's just a false choice.
How many people have these Cadillac plans, and how much money could be gleaned from taxing those?
I don't know the number offhand, and I don't think the tax is sufficient to pay for this program. I do think it will require Medicare cuts, period. I think that's going to be a large chunk of the savings they want to recoup. But I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you for your answer, sir.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Yes.
Thanks for the call, Ben. Our number is 800-486-8655. We have two lines open right now. They've been busy, so now would be a good time for you to call. Our guest on All Things Political this Monday, the 23rd of November, is Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second of our program today, we'll be speaking with the Senior Research Fellow in Health Policy at the Heritage Foundation. He has deep concerns about the bills in the House and in the Senate. 800-486-8655. We go to June from Toronto next. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, June.
My question, or my suggestion, is that the stimulus package is not working because the problems in this economy are structural, and this does not handle those problems. And back in the Depression era, the major portion of the people were agriculture, and they would go to problems that the stimulus package created. And the people who are losing jobs right now are in the service sector, and those people are not benefiting from this stimulus package.
That's a very good point. I mean, there one of the things that we've noticed in the past decade are certain structural flaws or challenges that the economy is facing. There are certain areas of the economy where jobs, again, have been fleeting in part because of global pressure, in part because certain areas of the economy are just closing up, and other reasons. And, you know, some saw this recession coming, meaning this is an exacerbation of the problems that have been emerging for a while now, for a decade or even two decades, combined with a collapse of our financial institutions, which also are structural problems. You know, there hasn't really been yet successful regulation proposed or passed by Congress in the wake of the financial collapse. What we focused on is bailing out financial institutions rather than on creating really new regulations as we did during the 1930s. So the stimulus money, it's true, it's a Band-Aid at this point. I think that was the intention. I think other proposals are aimed ideally at trying to curb some of the structural problems that we're dealing with. But on the financial front, for example, if you don't create regulations to prevent what happened on Wall Street, you can probably bet it will happen again. And so that's something the administration has to deal with.
Thanks, June. Scott from DeForest. Hi.
Hi there, Kathleen. I would like to ask this guest what his understanding is as to the opposition on the part of the Blue Dog Democrats to the public option. And what I'm trying to get to is, right now, the way the bill is written, as I understand it, states would have the option to opt out. Now, would the opposition to this be diminished at all if instead they turned it around and said states would have the would have an opt-in option? In other words, you'd actually have to vote yourself into a public plan, or would it not make a difference? Or are they just inherently opposed to the whole concept?
I think it might make it. Look, we have to remember we're talking about a handful of senators. When we're talking about either bipartisanship or the Blue Dogs in the Democratic Party, this is not a large group. It's a handful of people. I think if you had to opt in, you might actually increase the number of Democrats who would support that or be comfortable with it, two or three. That said, I think you might lose some liberal votes on that because I do think opting in is different than opting out, and it's harder to require governments to kind of formally buy into something as opposed to formally proactively rejecting something. So the question is, how many votes do you lose on that? Does someone like, you know, a Sanders, you know, just that's too much for him, or Feingold, or any of the people who are stronger behind the public option, do you lose their votes with that? But also, I do think it's taken on a kind of symbolic significance. I do think not all the opposition from the Blue Dogs is because of the details or particulars of the bill. It's become a way to show to voters in conservative states that will go Democratic that you are not for the most liberal elements of this administration. And when it becomes that symbolic for someone like Senator Nelson, it's then very hard to provide any compromise or rewrite that satisfies that political fear, because symbols in American politics are enormously powerful. And like it or hate it, the public option is now the symbol for the boldest effort, boldest intervention by government to deal with our health care.
So if you only have a handful who are opposed, those Blue Dog Democrats, and it's four, maybe five at the most, why not just say, skip them, we're going to reconciliation?
Well, reconciliation is a budgetary process that was created in 1974, and when this whole debate started, Democrats said we are willing to use reconciliation for health care. And why? Because that prohibits a filibuster. So that would be a bold political move. That would be forget the moderates. We're going to push this through, and all we need is a majority of the Senate, which they have to pass this. The first problem is that it's not clear that will work. There are all kinds of rules and restrictions on what can be included in reconciliation that the parliamentarian of the Senate would have to decide. And the second problem is that it would really anger those moderates, and you would certainly lose them on any other votes that you need them for down the line. And I think the administration is pretty nervous. I don't think they care about losing the Republican vote because they don't have them, but they do care about so alienating the moderates with a heavy-handed tactic. And most evidence is the administration is not going to do that.
Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say, though, Professor Zelizar, that you don't have much of a health care bill unless you have that option?
Well, there are people who disagree. I mean, there's a guy who writes for the Washington Post, Ezra Klein, who is a kind of big health care advocate, very liberal, And he argues the public option in the end is not the key to this bill. I mean, for a very good bill, what you need is this mandate combined with generous subsidies. That's really what's important, so that middle-class families have enough to buy the health care, combined with these exchanges, which in the end, he says, will really help consumers sort through what the choices are and force companies, if they want to play, to accept certain rules on issues like pre-existing conditions. And that's at the heart of this bill. It's not a perfect bill, but between 20 and 30 million people who don't have health care will have health care. And they say the public option is not central to this. So the argument is kind of where is the you never want to kill what's possible for what's perfect. So what's a decent possible option? And I think that's what Democrats have to decide behind closed chambers right now. How much is this public option worth? How essential is it to the success of this bill?
Martin from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. You know, the public option is, in fact, on an exchange, it's still a private insurance option that you pick. You know, it's not really anything close to universal health care. And when you look at the cost issues with health care, it's the, 30% of it goes to form processing of 1,300 insurance companies. And I think the liberal left, of whom I'm one, are very dissatisfied with this lack of fiscal conservatism to really address a significant cost reduction in health care. And we also have not seen anything in the way of financial regulation or true job creation. What happened to a high-speed rail on the interstate system that would totally transform the real estate and the investment economy in this country? To me, Obama has done nothing but buy a dog. He is so middle of the road. As a left-leaning liberal, how could I support that man or any of his supporters?
Those frustrations, I think, are not unique. I do think on the liberal, well, conservatives have kind of come to see Obama as this kind of an epitome of big government liberalism. I think there's many liberals who are kind of frustrated with the lack of action by this administration. And essentially, we have two bills over the year. The first, which was a stimulus bill that was not nearly as expansive as many liberals wanted, and now a health care bill, which I think when people step back is very middle of the road. I do agree with that assessment, and I think many liberals are going to say, you know, whatever happened to single-payer health insurance? How did we get this far? And this is basically what we end up with, a program that is quite limited in what it's going to do and potentially has leaks in it. And so I think going into 2010, you know, Obama has to worry about that as well. We've kind of listing the worries, independent, right, Republican opposition, and now I think there will be more liberal frustration. I still think if he gets the bill, a kind of, this is not a policy argument, but a political argument, it can be sold as a major victory, and that, you know, liberals still have no better option. And so maybe 50, 60, 70% of them expressing those frustrations will still go for the Democrats because they'll see this as the best thing possible. But I do think Obama has been a pragmatist. He is a pragmatic Democrat. He is a Clintonian Democrat. It's one of the ironies of the first year, a guy who defeated Hillary Clinton by saying she was too middle of the road, she was too much of a compromiser, has proved to be a president who lives in the Clinton model of Democratic governance.
He's got to get something in terms of health care reform, doesn't he?
Absolutely. I think it's so crucial to his political future and to the Democratic Party. If they come out of this year, we're now in November, Thanksgiving is almost here. If we reach the new year and this somehow falls apart, deal, all he has is an economic stimulus. And this is a guy elected with the promise of change, with the promise of kind of a bold vision of where the country needs to go. I don't think that would be very satisfactory to many voters, and that could really imperil his presidency. And if Republicans are able to kill this, his signature legislation, they are going to go after anything he does with a kind of level of intensity that we haven't actually seen yet.
Matt, Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking pretty much exclusively about what the Congress is doing about health care, but I'm wondering what role the Supreme Court is going to have in this plan. the idea that the federal government will mandate that people purchase an insurance policy from private enterprises, the insurance companies, I think is unprecedented in the history of this country. And so I'm wondering if this won't all land in the lap of the Supreme Court, which has, you know, a conservative majority and has been trending towards reining in the federal government's ability to make claims under, like, the Commerce Clause in particular and maybe even the General Welfare Clause, that it can do anything. So they've been kind of shrinking the government's ability to claim that it has the power to do broad things, you know, by just citing the Commerce Clause, for example. So where is the authority going to come from, and is it all going to end up with the conservative Supreme Court?
I'm not a constitutional expert, so I want to be kind of cautious in answering that. But I do think, you know, there are precedents for bringing the federal government, bringing citizens into programs where private entities have a role. Medicare is one example, where Blue Cross Blue Shield, for example, was very important at the beginning. And there are other kind of forms of government expansion that were seen as potentially unconstitutional, even Social Security, our agriculture programs, which were sometimes knocked down and redone, but which nonetheless survived. So I'm not sure that constitutional challenge would necessarily hold up. I do think the constitutional challenge will be made because we've now heard it. Whether it ends up in the Supreme Court, who knows?
Thanks, Matt. Mike from Appleton, our next caller. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, two quick questions. One very practical one and one that's kind of outlandish. the practical one. As we go to this single payer, which I think is inevitable if the public option passes, what happens to all of the people who work in insurance, be it insurance companies, insurance agents? I mean, there must be...
Well, you're way ahead of the game here, I think. You think a single payer is inevitable, Professor Zelizer, if there is a public option?
I don't think so at this point. I understand the question. I understand,
right,
you know, what happens to an entire industry. But I think we're so far away from that right now. I don't think many people in the insurance industry are very nervous. I think they're actually excited because this will be a huge bonus to the industry. These healthcare exchanges are going to bring in millions of customers into private health insurance. So I don't think we're going in that direction, even with a public option, which will just be one option among many.
If it would be an indication, wouldn't it, though, that if we ever went that way, which I can't see us going that way, that a public option worked better than what we have now, and so we went to a complete public option?
Can you repeat that? I'm not quite sure.
That it would be successful. It would be, if we had a public option, if he says if it's inevitable that we get single payer,
yeah,
then he's saying it's inevitable that that system would work better than the system we have now.
Yeah, well, yeah, right. I mean, the question is, once you put this into place, does it build support for more of a program? So if you have a public option and it works pretty well, do you then say, well, why aren't we just doing it all through some kind of public option? But again, that's many steps removed. And I think, like, the public option is symbolically very charged at this point. Single payer seems just symbolically dead in the United States at this point, again, whether you like it or don't. So I think it would be very hard to dismantle our private insurance industry. I think that's the basic issue people are realizing. Moving from one system to another is very difficult when one of these systems is so well entrenched and so integrated into our economy. So I just don't think we're going to go that way, even if the public option is part of the mix and even if it works. I think it will just be a system of choice.
Sarah Palin, is she a force to be reckoned with?
Well, she's certainly a media force to be reckoned
with. Is she ever?
And I think that's where, you know, she quit the governorship and she's made her name. She might be the next Oprah. And she's out there. But I think all the vulnerabilities and liabilities that were exposed in 2008 remained. And right now, she's not being evaluated as a candidate. She's being evaluated as a celebrity. And people, I think, forget that. And so her books sell. She's, you know, doing well on television. That doesn't mean she could run again and not, you know, fall into all the same problems that we saw in 2008. So she'll continue. I don't know if she's going to run or not, but I still don't think that's the best bet for the Republican Party. I think that's a mistake if that's how the party wants to rebuild themselves.
We have time for one more call. A minute left. Mike from Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. I just want to make a comment.
currently, with the education system that we have in the country, it is a public option where you have private enterprises that have their own schools, but you also have a very strong public option there. Could the Democrats strengthen their position on a strong public option by pointing out that we have a successful education system with a public option?
That's a dangerous one. I mean, Obama tried to do that with the post office and said, why not have a public option? We do that with our mail system, and FedEx is doing just fine, even though we have public mail. The problem is a lot of people don't like the mail system, and there's a lot of critics of the public education system, and that would open up a whole can of worms about the system of education that I'm not sure the Democrats want to get into at this point. So it's true we have many kind of areas where government's very involved, from subsidizing agriculture to teaching our children. But I think Democrats are still very much in the ear of Reagan and nervous about too strong of an advocacy of these programs, and also aware that that will open up another set of debates that they just can't handle right now.
Yeah. Professor Zelizer, thank you so much. Always a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest this hour, Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He also is a news commentator for CNN.com, so you can read him regularly there, and author of many books, including coming out very soon, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production as well. We have news coming up, and we'll be back with more conversation on the Ideas Network.